Welcome to Bounce Back Stronger, the podcast that explores ways to find peace and purpose after difficulty. I'm your host, Donna Ferris, and today we have best-selling author, psychologist, and scholar Stephen Cope with us. A little bit about Stephen. Stephen's works, which include Yoga and the Quest for the True Self, The Great Work of Your Life, and The Wisdom of Yoga, beautifully connect ancient wisdom with modern psychology, offering profound insights into our humanity. His latest book, The Dharma in Difficult Times, written during the pandemic, shines a light through life's darkest moments, guiding us toward our true calling. As scholar in residence at Kripalu Center for nearly three decades, Stephen has helped countless individuals, myself included, navigate the transformative power of yoga and meditation. And Stephen also founded the Kripalu Institute for Extraordinary Living to help seekers explore the mind-body-spirit connection. With honors including Telly and Apple Awards and a nod from Yoga Journal as one of America's top yoga influencers, Stephen Cope's impact on wellness and growth is pervasive and profound. Stephen, thank you so much for being here today. It's truly an honor to speak with you.
Thank you, Donna. What a lovely introduction.
Oh, it's easy to do. It was easy to do. I have followed you for some time. We have met several times. You probably don't remember me, but we've met several times. I've been into your Great Work of Your Life workshop. I was at one of your meditation workshops with Sharon Salzberg, which is how I met Sharon. So it's just so nice to have a chance to talk to you like this. So thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm so delighted you've been to Kripalu. Good. So you know a lot more about me.
That's okay. Yeah, Kripalu has really been responsible for a lot of my transformation. I went at a really difficult time for me. So I'm sure that's something that might be a good place to start. Like, what have you seen in your years there in terms of transformation?
I mean, I started like you did. I landed at Kripalu when I was in the middle of a very bad breakup, a divorce, and I was 40. I had a great life, an established career, and it pretty much blew the lid off things. I had a psychoanalytic psychotherapy practice in Boston that was flourishing, but I needed to go someplace and just calm down and think about things and gather myself. And I was going to go to this Episcopal monastery in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which I know very well. My buddy said, "Oh, you got to check out this place called Kripalu. It'd be perfect because, like, the monks in the monastery, they all get fat and maybe drink too much. That won't happen to you at Kripalu." So I went with them for a weekend to Kripalu. I loved it.
Yeah.
You know, for those of you listeners who haven't been there, it's on a mountaintop in the Berkshires. It's absolutely gorgeous. I went there for the weekend, and I ended up moving there for a year sabbatical to really go deeper into my practice of yoga and meditation. And I was deeply into Buddhist meditation at that point. And then after the year was over, I stayed, and I've been there now. I'm scholar emeritus there now, and I've been there for 35 years. I didn't go home.
Does that happen often?
Yeah, it does. Remarkable.
It does, right?
Yeah. No, people, I mean, most people probably don't have as much freedom as I did then because I was unattached, but many people come and find their spiritual home there and find whatever their religious or spiritual background, the practice is there to be extremely helpful. And just the holding environment that is that this big, beautiful retreat center becomes their spiritual home. And so either they stay for a long time or they come back many times and dip back in over and over again. And the transformation I see is remarkable. And now I've had decades of watching people transform and arrive really in serious breakdown and, you know, and then as slowly put themselves back together, but in a new way and in a terrific way.
Yeah.
That's just what happened to me. So sounds like you too.
Yeah. As you were talking, I was thinking, you know, of that time and it was probably one of the first times I'd ever been alone, really, and without a purpose, which I think is really helpful. And it's almost like going on a cruise ship a little bit because there's tons of things to do. They feed you really well, but good food, right? But they feed you really well. And then you really have time to think about yourself. And there's experiences, and you were responsible for a lot of these experiences. There's experiences that allow you to question things about your life in a space where people actually listen to you, which is incredible.
This is one of the things people love most. We have so a very structured day. And when you're doing a deep dive into your spiritual practice, structure is really important. So starting the day with yoga and meditation and then great food, we have silent breakfast and then workshops very often in which you'll be in a sharing circle where you get to share what's going on with you, do some introspection. So the whole day is really structured around a balance between personal introspection and sharing and group connection, which is so life-giving.
Yeah. And I guess this was a great backdrop for the work that you have done in terms of your writing. So maybe we take a moment here. I mean, your current book is The Dharma of Difficult Times. And as I read The Great Work of Your Life, I notice how you're really pulling from The Great Work of Your Life. And then to a certain extent, some of your other works too, but that's probably the one that's really feeding this one, right?
It is. I mean, I got interested in what happens when we face in life, and I think this is your bailiwick, when we face dilemmas in life that profoundly disorient us, right? So those big dilemmas that really break apart our very understanding of how the world works. Now, I began this book before COVID because I'd had this really difficult, strange experience. I work with a lot of major institutions, medical schools, and the whole thing. And one of the big institutions that I work with of education treated me terribly. And I was so angry and upset. And it kind of blew my socks off. And I had to look at this whole idea of what I call disorienting dilemmas, right? And the way in which they force you to dig deeper into your very view of the world. Like, what, okay, then how does this work? How could this happen? How does this work? These stories of disorienting dilemmas that actually lead to breakthroughs are kind of central to the whole contemplative tradition. So in Buddhism, for example, you have the Buddha as a young man living in his father's palace, being protected from the realities of old age, illness, and death, right? And of course, the great story is he gets out. One of the servants helps him get out on a regular basis from the palace, and he sees an aging person, he sees a dead person, he sees an ill person, and it blows him away. And it causes him to have to think deeply about what's the nature of life, what's the nature of suffering. And these are called the four holy messengers. The fourth messenger, of course, was he saw a holy person who was completely at ease in the midst of all of this difficulty. And this is what forced him then to uproot himself, leave his father's palace and his wife and young son, and take to the hills to study yoga and meditation as it was in those days, which was about the 5th century BC, before the Common Era. And again, digging deeply into what's the nature of life and what's the root of suffering and how is it possible to attenuate it. So that's just one of the many archetypal stories of the disorienting dilemma and the way that it can lead to profound fruition in terms of our understanding of the world and how it works.
And it's really about understanding that that is how life works, right? We do have these. To expect anything different, it's the resistance of that that creates our suffering, right? I think part of your message maybe is, and tell me if I'm wrong, is finding purpose, right? So in the fact that you know that life is suffering and that we are here for a limited time, what better time to not be in a trance, right? And really looking at your life as a gift, and how are you going to make purpose of it? Would that make sense?
Totally. So part of the delusion in which most of us live is organized around our egos, right? So the Buddha said, and in the yoga tradition, all the Eastern contemplative traditions said, the root of suffering, once the Buddha finally got to it, is grasping, craving, clinging, holding on, aversion, hatred, and delusion. And there are two different forms of grasping that cause suffering. One is reaching for something. I want that. I crave that. And the other is protecting. Okay, I've got that bundle of money. Now I'm going to protect it, right? Mm-hmm. So these three are called the greed, hatred, and delusion are called the three poisons. And a disorienting dilemma that leads to a spiritual inquiry will inevitably shed light on, oh, wow, why am I suffering? It's about I'm identified with my ego, with how big I think I should be, who I think I should be, what I'm attached to, or what I'm averse to. And so spiritual practice in the Eastern contemplative traditions always leads to a seeing through into the roots of our daily mundane suffering, and allows us to connect with something deeper, a deeper knowing, a deeper seeing, a deeper understanding of how the whole works, and therefore a deeper understanding of how we might fit into it. What's my role? What's my purpose? All of the contemplative traditions, especially yoga, sees that every human being has a purpose, a true calling, a sacred duty, and that in the best of times, all of life is really for each of us to discern what that is, to understand what that is, and then to do it full out. So you've been in my course on the great work, and you know the four pillars: discern your dharma or your calling, do it with everything you've got, let go of the outcome, this is the one that cuts through the ego, and turn it over to God or to something, some purpose bigger than your small self, than your ego.
Right, the surrender.
So, and surrender and let it go. So in Dharma of Difficult Times, I start with Gandhi, because Gandhi had this fascinating experience when he came back to India after working in South Africa for 20 years. He confronted the massive suffering that was India in the 1920s and 30s. And he spent 7 months traveling around the country, and he was completely blown away by what he saw. And he didn't know how he could possibly contribute or what his role might be. It was all just too overwhelming. And of course, Nehru and the others were encouraging him to get to work and become an activist and dive right in. And what does Gandhi say? Gandhi says, that's not the path. What I'm going to do is I'm going to get quiet. And so for about a year, he went to an ashram that he founded, and he spent a year meditating, sitting quietly, raising crops, spinning cotton into thread. And as a result of that discerning move, he settled down, he calmed down, he began to identify not with grasping, aversion, and delusion, but with his awake mind, his discerning mind. And it was out of that was born his real role, his real leadership in the freeing of India. It was while he was on that year that he came up with the brilliant move of marching to the sea to make salt, which was the beginning of the end of the British Raj in India. But I wanted to start with that story because it's a perfect evocation of what you do when you're confronted with, you would call it adversity, I'm calling it the disorienting dilemma. The tendency is to want to go right into action, which is really reaction. And the path is really, no, calm down, sit down, breathe, do your meditation practice, your yoga, and connect with the native wisdom, with what the Buddhists would call awake mind, and allow that to lead you step by step into what your real deepest vocation is.
I totally agree. I think there's steps in there too, right? Though, but you have to accept it's actually happening to you. So many people don't even do that, right? A lot of times we're walking around in a trance and we're numbing first. So one of the things I try to remind people is that it's actually happening. I think one of the things that I got out of yoga early was the practice of how are you feeling in the beginning of a class. And right. I don't think I ever asked myself that question. I didn't even know it should be something I worry about. So I think there definitely is that spot where you have to kind of understand where you're at and accept that you're in a bad situation, and then it's sitting with it. I think that is absolutely important. And for me, I'm actually working through a book, and I start off with meditation, and then I kind of take people into, you got to realize where you're at, and then not resisting it. I spent a lot of time in life resisting it and numbing it, and when it's so much faster to just notice it's there and accept it, much faster.
Exactly. But where in our culture do we learn that? We don't learn that at all. We learn about numbing and distracting ourselves.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially, there are two paths in life. Either you can choose the path of distraction, or you can choose the path of deepening and going down into those feelings. And you're so right. I mean, that's a beautiful step to point out, Donna, because most of us don't know what we're feeling, strangely enough. And this requires a turn toward the body and sensation. And this is where yoga is so brilliant. Quickly after coming to Prapallo, I noticed that when we asked people why they were there, like 80% of them said, I want to come home to myself. There's this feeling like I'm not at home in myself. I'm not anywhere near. So this kind of desperation to come home to someplace that felt like home. And what is that? Well, that's being at ease with how it is in the body, how it is in the mind, beginning to notice that constant voice you have in the mind, beginning to notice how it all is, and being okay with it, just as you say.
Yeah, and I think it's also knowing that you're acting outside of who you really want to be. I think that's a key thing, at least for me, was there is a divine self that I am not honoring at this time. And I think that's that was a hard thing for me, is that my life was kind of, you know, moving in a lot of different directions. The numbing was part of that. But also, it just wasn't the type of life that I really wanted. And I think that's really, a lot of us feel that, I think, when we come into Kripalu. It's, we're searching for something. We don't know what that is. I don't think I could have articulated it in the way I just did then.
Yeah.
You know, after kind of looking at it and writing about it, now I know that there's this person I want to be in situations, regardless of the stimulus. And I'm not saying I always am able to do that at all, but I needed to know that was possible. And I think with meditation in particular, but with yoga too, because yoga gives, like you said, it gives you the clues that something's going on in your body, that your body's going to tell you all the stuff, just like the book says, right? The body keeps the score. It's going to tell you what is the thing. And I find that's the benefit of yoga. And again, being at Kripalu, because you get thrown into this new environment where it gives you that space to kind of go, oh, this is what I was looking for. This is what I want to be. And you don't know how to get there necessarily at that time, but it does give you that kind of rumbles you so that you can start to notice that there's something outside of you that you really want. And that maybe it's inside of you too.
I love what you just said, Donna. We don't necessarily know what we're looking for, but there is, I've come to believe, in human beings, a kind of homing mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
When we're not at home, we long for it. Even though it's very inchoate, we don't know what it is, but we know that we're not there. You know, I tell the story of my beautiful little Shetland sheepdog who got lost in Boston once and found his way across this huge urban landscape back to our little house in Dorchester on the South Shore. I don't know how he did it, but I realized human beings have that kind of homing mechanism too, that knows home and wants to find it. What the yoga tradition calls dukkha and the Buddhist tradition as well, is that sense of unsatisfactoriness that we feel when we're not home. Dukkha.
That's a good word.
It literally means unsatisfactoriness. Like the first thing that you do at Kripalu is to get permission to feel that. It's okay to feel that. I think people often feel like if they were to feel that, they would blow apart. If they were to feel the pain of not being home, being the pain of dukkha, but actually it leads you home. So it's a good thing.
Yeah. Well, it tells you that there's something, and I want to say unmanaged. It's a very business way of looking at it, but there's definitely something that's worrying them and you don't know what it is. And I think that's the urge that people get when they want to go out and drinking and they want to go out and I look back because I'm sober now and I look back at that feeling and I still have, you know, that feeling, but I do something different with it. But I think that's what's happening is people have those feelings and they don't know what to do with them. And when sitting with them and tying yourself to simple things like being grateful, it's what Tara Brach calls the trance, right? It's like you're in that trance and you need to realize that that's normal, but you are the one that can get you out of it.
Right.
You have the ability to leave it. And there's a lot of different things to do that. If you were to name some other than meditation, what other things do you think take you out of that trance that we get into?
You know, anything that really brings you home to the body, this is why the Buddha was so brilliant. He said, awakening happens in this fathom-long body. So anything that brings you home to feel a sense of the sensations in the inner world, and it doesn't have to be fancy, and it doesn't have to be You know, my great friend Sylvia Boorstein, great Buddhist teacher and good friend of Sharon's, often says, look, even if you just came to Kripalu for 2 weeks and walked in the woods and worked and ate well, you would slowly begin to tune in to this inner world, this world of sensation, and that has so many gifts. And it's absolutely right. And the techniques that we use, yoga and meditation and, you know, and chanting and mantra and diet and walking meditation and so many of the tools are simply meant to allow us to quiet down enough to connect with that still small voice inside, which is what's really going to lead us to who we want to be. And so at Kripalu and likewise at Spirit Rock and everywhere else, is a great retreat center. Everything is organized around helping you to calm down and reconnect with that inner world.
Yeah. It is a magical place. You're making me want to go back. I got to get back. You've been recognized as one of the most influential thinkers and writers and teachers. And how do you see the landscape of yoga changing? Is it changing? It feels like through the pandemic, we lost a little bit of the connection that we had. I think probably little is probably a smaller word than needs to be there. It's a lot of connection. What are your thoughts around where we are in the yoga world today?
Honestly, the COVID disaster challenge opportunity disrupted something that was moving in the yoga world in the direction that I loved, which was very often people will come to Kripalu, say, and begin with basic postures. And eventually those postures lead into a deeper meditation practice and a deeper understanding of the kind of metaphysics and the philosophy of these great Eastern traditions. And I began to see the yoga world in America moving inexorably in that direction, right? From the more superficial, how much weight can I lose in this yoga class? to the little awakening that happens in those moments in yoga when you're in your yoga nidra and you sense something deeper within. Well, what I've noticed, and again, I live here in an urban center in Albany, is that unfortunately, COVID wiped out many of our yoga studios that were already quite marginal financially, living on the edge. And here in Albany, we've ended up with really one yoga studio, a big one and a fabulous one where I practice almost every day. But a lot of those smaller yoga centers that were really beginning to inculcate us into deeper practice got wiped out. And yeah. I think that's really set us back, unfortunately.
I agree. And I'm not against online yoga. I mean, I think you have to meet people where they are. And I think there's a lot of benefits, but there is so much to be gained by being with other people and in a room. And there's nothing like, you know, a rolling ohm in a room. You know, there's nothing like just the energy that is there. So I do really miss what's happened to the yoga world.
We all need that community, but also as you dive deeper into the practices, you begin to get deeper into the root of suffering and your own suffering and how you can mitigate it. And right now I see, even in my own wonderful studio, I don't run it, I'm just an attendee there, but I see that there's still more of a superficial, how does my body look? It's much more organized around ego. That's good. That's fine. Nothing wrong with that. How do I feel? All of that. But to get into the real genius of these traditions is to get into what are the real roots of your pain and your suffering and you're not knowing yourself. And there's no question in my mind that COVID disrupted that.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't have those. I mean, I always think of yoga kind of as a, and I'm sure this is something you've heard of many times, but, you know, as an experience that we're giving them so that they can work on things in their life, right? You're stressing them. You're making them work and not know what's coming next. You're really kind of disorienting them in a nice way, right? So that they can have this experience. And I don't know, I think we have some of that in, you know, some of these fitness oriented types of yoga, but you don't have the kind of care and the philosophical discussions that you can have in a class today. And I miss that.
The one place I think that's positive though, Donna, is I am seeing yoga infiltrate the world of allopathic medicine much more. I mean, the other day I had a long chat with my cardiologist and he told me he'd discovered Bikram yoga and it changed his life. And he was recommending it to everybody. And I'm having this little bout of cancer right now. And so I've been down at Sloan Kettering in New York, one of the great cancer centers. And they have a whole yoga program and meditation. And they're really
awesome.
So these allopathic kind of mainstream medicine is now being joined much more frequently by the complementary and alternative strategies of yoga and meditation. And they're being prescribed by doctors. This is fabulous. And this is why 15 years ago, I founded the Research Institute at Kripalu, because we understood that we had to show really what the effects and mechanisms of yoga really were in a scientific way in order to have yoga accepted by the mainstream medical community. That is happening. And that's a good thing.
That is a good thing. Yeah. And maybe for the audience that might not know, so maybe three benefits, particularly to maybe some of the ailments you've discussed just now, and I'm so sorry that you're going through what you're going through. But, you know, maybe some of those benefits would be great for people to know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there are three classic benefits to yoga practice. The first one is simply it calms you down, okay? I'm saying that in a much more simple fashion than our scientists might say, but it deeply relaxes the nervous system, the vagus nerve that controls all of the major organ systems is toned. And there's a reason why yoga postures in the great eight-limb path of yoga, yoga postures and breathing practices come before meditation, because they're a physiological direct route into the deepening of stress and the, you know, increasing alertness and relaxation, a relaxed, alert kind of quality. Yeah. So that's the first thing, which is fabulous. The second thing, as you go deeper in your practice, is seeing things more clearly, right? So seeing what the real root of suffering is. Oh, the real reason I'm suffering is not that I didn't get that. It's the grasping and the craving for it. Mm-hmm. And it's the fact that all things are impermanent. And, you know, we live in a world of impermanence, and seeing and accepting that as the nature of reality. And then finally, seeing how deeply we're connected to one another, our profound interconnection. All of those things are fruits of yoga practice. Now that I'm in treatment for cancer, I do a deep yoga practice every day, and it's so nourishing, taking me right back to home base, to a profound inner sense of well-being. Like, everything is okay. Everything is really okay. As it says at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, like, you can't kill this true nature of ours, which is consciousness, awareness, awakened mind. And so every day I get on my mat and I go home. And it's a beautiful way to antidote any kind of freak out I might have in my mind about what's going on and where it might lead.
I think you said that incredibly well. It lets you come home and lets you remember who you really are.
It's right there.
The chatter of the mind, it lets you calm the chatter of the mind, which really isn't real. It's not your divine self.
In most of the suffering that we have in life is not a result of our life circumstance, but mm-mm. what our mind is saying about it, right?
Yeah.
This is what the Buddhists call the second arrow. The first arrow is, oh, there is pain. There is pain in life. I'm experiencing a little of it now.
Right.
But suffering is actually the resistance to that pain, is the story that we tell ourselves about it, the catastrophizing about it. And we can cut that right in half with the knife of meditation and yoga practice.
What Sharon Salzberg says is it's the awareness, right? I was away for a moment. Hold on. I got to come back. I love that.
To the present moment.
Yeah, which isn't that bad.
Which isn't that bad. I'm okay right now. You're okay right now.
Yeah, exactly.
It's sunset here in New York.
Yeah.
So, you know, we used to have at Kripalu, we had this wonderful Swami who came from India, well, Canada, essentially, but he taught us this mantra, which is, everything is already okay.
Yeah.
And I use that a lot. Like, in my true nature, he would say, everything is already okay. And I even repeat it in his voice because it was so soothing, because it's true. Everything's fundamentally okay. And that's where you want to live.
Yep. That's one of my favorite things favorite mantras before going to sleep at night. I think it's really helpful because that's a time when you can get into rumination and to be able to just say, everything is going to be okay. You know, and he's saying it differently. He's saying everything is already okay, which is another twist, right? It's kind of the next level. But it just helps to be able to say that, you know, and helps to remind yourself, because you can get so tied up in things. And you know, big things happen. It's not that they're not important, but in this moment, you know, we are okay.
Well, you know what always surprises me, Donna, is that most people don't really know that there's this monologue going on in their mind that's constantly narrating our life experience. Don't even know that that exists.
Yeah.
Much less have they found techniques to interrupt it, to notice it. Oh, let's see, I'm suffering right now. What's going on in my mind? Oh, my mind's telling me that something's wrong, but mm-hmm. it's not. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge awakening moment for people when they get, oh my God, there is this constant narration in my mind. that's actually causing half of my suffering.
That's
Yeah.
right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Is it 90% of our thoughts are the same as the day before, which is, and I think there's like, they just did the stat. I think it's like there's 30,000 of them. So like, it's a lot. So that's a lot of repeating thoughts.
30,000 thoughts a day.
Yeah, exactly. And 90% of them were the same. I'm like, I knew I was boring, but boy.
No, I mean, that's the nature of human being. We're pattern making animals.
Yeah.
But once you start to get on and you see that pattern, oh, wow. Then you start noticing it throughout the day. Oh, I just played that tape again. I just played that same tape. And it's simply bringing awareness to it that begins to evaporate it. Like just by noticing it, it begins to lose half of its power.
Yeah.
So this is a very simple thing.
Yeah. And it works with major obstacles that you're dealing with, and also people. I think it's important to know that, you know, you can, no matter what they think, and again, that's you know, some of the grasping the things, you know, I want everybody to like me and all that types of things. You can rid yourself of that too by just remembering that those are all thoughts, and you are okay the way you are, as you are now.
Exactly. So yeah. Much of it is just thought. And then there are these lovely moments when in yoga practice or meditation or just walking your dog,
yep.
You have a moment when you drop down into that deeper world where it's really quiet and clear, and you remember who you are. And that's so powerful. Those moments are so powerful.
They are. Is there anything else you want to share before we go?
Well, I will say this. Look, I'm 74 years old. I've been meditating for 50 years now. And it has so profoundly changed my life. And in the last few years, I heard Jack Kornfield use this word fruition about 10 years ago in a personal talk he and I were having. And it is true that the practice of meditation early on is challenging. There's a lot to learn about how to meditate. It doesn't have to be disastrously challenging, but there's a learning curve. But once you learn how to meditate, there's no upper limit. And of course, you get this from 12 Step too. There's no upper limit to the amount of happiness you can have. And I have this experience of fruition these days in my meditation, where I just honestly have profound experiences of bliss and rapture, and way beyond everything is okay. And so these practices, they mature within us. Half of my friends in the world are in their 40s, and I'm constantly saying, look, dude, you have to learn to meditate. Promise me that you will learn these practices, because the quotient of happiness that's going to be yours, there's nothing else I could give you that's better than that. Now, half of them will never do it.
No.
I don't know why, but for those of you who are listening, learn to meditate and learn to do yoga. They're twins, as you know, twin practices. And please have that experience of fruition as you grow older in these practices. That's what I want to say to people.
Thank you so much. That's the perfect end. Well, I really, really appreciate your time and all of your work. It's been so inspiring for me. So thank you.
Thank you. Great to see you again. And
good
to know
that
I've seen you before and listened. That's awesome.
Thank you so much. That's all for today. If you want to learn more about Stephen's books, retreats, and events, those links will be in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening. I hope this episode was helpful. If it was, please subscribe, drop a review, or share it with your friends and family. That's the best way to get it in the hands of those who may benefit. And if my daughters, Sienna and Sylvie, are listening, I just want you to know how proud I am of you, and I love you so much. Bye now.